Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist. Join me as I seek out the small incremental changes being applied in other industries that we can learn from and that can be applied in healthcare. Can these changes bring immediate value, but also add up to the big improvements and revolution we need in healthcare? Come along with me to explore the possibilities. My innovative guests from around the globe have used small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot.
And today, I'm delighted to be joined by Richard Vincent. He is the Chief Executive Officer and co-founder of Fundamental VR. Richard, thanks for joining me today.
Dr. Nick, thanks for having me. Great to join you.
So obviously, we're going to confuse the audience. They're not going to be able to separate our dulcet tones because we've both got those delightful British accents. Mine comes from a heritage of training in the United Kingdom. For the benefit of the listeners, can you share a little bit of your background and how you got to this position and this activity with Fundamental VR?
Yeah, sure. Very happy to do so. So my background is definitely a technologist through and through. I started 25 years ago in the area of mobile technology, mobile phone technology, when that was a very nascent market, and worked with it and through it, building applications and applying that technology to business problems during the early 2000s and through to 2010, 2011. Really interesting going through a market that went from very early stage to full penetration and adoption during that period. Prior to that, I'd always worked within the technology sphere and arena, but really focused on the communication and the application of that technology. And it's really those two backgrounds that brought me to where we are today with Fundamental. So about 5-6 years ago, I started to look at new emerging technology with my business partner to try and predict, which is always impossible, but try and predict the areas which might be exciting going forward. We managed to do it with mobile in the late 90s, and we found when we looked at it in the 2010 period, it was really the immersive technology and particularly virtual reality that stood out as an opportunity to again change the human computing interface, as mobile has done over the last 15 years. So I took a decision with my co-founder to really focus in on that and look at where the application of that could be most prevalent and where it could have the most impact, both as a business, but also from a societal point of view, which is what led us to our platform, Fundamental Surgery.
So in fact, you didn't start down the track of healthcare specifically. You started down the track of virtual reality and the associated technologies and where it could be applied. Is that true?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So it was definitely a case of looking at the way that technology might develop and looking at the different potential vertical markets you could align it to. And the one that we felt had the biggest opportunity over the next few years to create that alignment was in the medical space. So I'm not medically trained by background, but I run a medical business. I have a great selection of medical experts around us. And I think what my background allows me to do is to look much broader than just the surgical or the medical objectives, but actually think about the much bigger platform, the technology platform that needs to be in place to deliver the surgical objectives and the medical objectives that our end users need today and will desire for the future.
So before we dive into that, I just want to ask you, because when I think about VR and certainly back in that era, the first place that really sort of seemed to take off in terms of the application excitement was the gaming industry. Was that not an area that was interesting, or was it? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, it was the natural landing zone for VR at its first iteration back in the 90s. And then obviously as it started to be reborn again through Palmer Luckey and the Oculus contingent that started to develop. I mean, I took a decision that there was a lot of people focusing on that particular application, and that my background isn't particularly in the gaming space, so we decided to stay away from that one deliberately.
Right.
But we looked at a number of areas. We looked at collaboration, we looked at news reporting, we looked at different ways you could use that technology, and they were all interesting, and some of the applications that came out of them were pretty good. But what we felt was that you could walk away from any one of those. Whereas when we looked at the way we were starting to develop the medical side of our business, what we felt was that there was something you found very hard as a business to walk away from, i.e. its impact, whether you're a healthcare professional, whether you're a healthcare provider, or whether you're a life sciences business, the potential impact of this technology was so much greater. And so we followed it down that route.
You know, the only one that you mentioned there that gives me sort of pause for thought is news reporting. And I'm trying to imagine virtual reality with news reporting. Just, I don't know, there's a part of me that's kind of terrified about that, because I don't want to live the news for real. Just going to tell you.
Well, there is a bit of that, yeah. And you know, the logistics of actually bringing three-dimensional spatial computing into live reporting is pretty heavy lifting.
Right.
And we just... it's technically possible. The reality is, in most cases, it probably wouldn't happen.
Fascinating. I don't think I've ever heard that, but now you've really made me think. I'm going to start thinking about that anytime I watch the news. So you got into healthcare, clearly, you know, huge impact, huge opportunity, understand the sort of, you know, steering away from an existing gaming infrastructure. Tell us a little bit about that journey. I mean, obviously, with that extensive technology background, all of this mobile technology, I guess increasing network access, speed of access as much as anything. What were the sort of significant inflection points that, you know, got you to the point that you're at now?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it started very much with a lot of very detailed conversations with people who today are educating in the medical space and trying to understand some of the challenges that they faced. And what we kept hearing was, firstly, you know, across most of the developed nations, there's a shortage in time available to trainee surgeons. That's been decreasing in the EU because of working time directives. It's been decreasing in the US for similar drivers. The fact is, people get much less exposure today to cases than they used to, and that's a challenge. The second one is, it was the shortage of time available to the educators. You know, if the medical world runs a pretty much an apprentice type model,
right?
And that's very heavy dependent on me as the educator to be there to instruct and to observe. That slows the whole process down. And then you've got the macro one. I think this was the big tipping point, really, for me, was you know, the World Health Authority talk about 5 billion people worldwide not having access to good surgical skills. And there's lots of drivers behind that, but undoubtedly one of them is the time, the effort, and the expense of surgical education. So if you're able to democratize the way that that training happens, then you start to move things on quite a lot. So we started very much in those conversations rather than what could we do with the tech. Then we took a good hard look at the technology and said, you know, it's the potential is there, and we can see already in the last 3-4 years how fast that's moved on, and we've been able to push some of those envelopes with some of the platform providers. But the one big gap that was there was the ability to touch. So, you know, I want to teach you how to operate, which has been our focus at Fundamental Surgery. You know, our focus is very much about surgical training. I want to teach you those skills. If I try and do that without giving you the sense of touch, I'm going to top out at a certain point. It doesn't mean that there isn't validity in that training, because becoming familiar with the steps and seeing it is, of course, useful. But ultimately, if I want you to learn what it feels like, how much pressure to apply, when to apply it, how to apply it, in areas where often you can't actually see what you're doing, well, then our virtual reality experience had to have that sense of touch, which, you know, the industry called haptics. So that was probably our biggest aha moment in the development of the early platform. It's like, how do we bring touch in, and how do we bring it in a way that's truly scalable? And that's when we started down probably our next most expensive development part, which was the touch through a number of different pieces of hardware.
Right. So, you know, before we dive into that, I just want to take you back a few years, because it's fascinating to hear you talk about that, you know, democratizing of access. And just recently, there was a piece that talked about the huge explosion of YouTube videos, essentially I don't want to say homemade, that feels wrong, but you know, certainly not professionally produced, of clinicians essentially showing how to do different procedures that has become the staple for residents in training in the medical system, medical students that the sort of access, and all of that is sort of, I want to say, unofficial. It sounds like you've sort of intersected with that space and offer a potential pathway for a more rigorous training environment. Did you see some of that?
Yeah. I think the last time we did the count, we got up to about 190,000 surgical videos that we could find on YouTube.
And please send me that list because I want to redo my skill.
The danger with those videos is exactly that. There's no validation on them, so you don't know whether that's actually good technique or bad technique. You know, they're right. Like anything, reliable sources are good, where they've been published from med device companies, life sciences, or well-known institutions. But there's a lot that are published under individual names, and they are used constantly as reference points. So making sure you're looking at a good example is key. Absolutely, I think, you know, that was one of the drivers for us, is looking at the way that new technology can be used, and some of it needs to be managed and created rather than created, you know, and I think that's where some of the opportunities in the future lie. It's great to be able to place those videos on, but what we found also is that, you know, when you actually look at those videos in detail, some of them are very good production standards, some not so much. Sometimes, because of the way the lighting works, you actually find it hard to see exactly what's happening. You know, you get the overall impression, but if you stop and zoom in and look at the detail, it's actually hard to see the techniques often being deployed.
Yeah, you obviously bring up, for anybody that does any kind of video, they know that, you know, lighting and audio are the two sort of key things which are very difficult to control, especially if you're sort of doing this with the portable devices that we have. So I think absolutely correct. So for those of you just joining, I'm Dr. Nick, the incrementalist. I'm talking with Richard Vincent. He's the CEO and co-founder of Fundamental VR. We were just talking about their sort of historical path to this and how they got here. And you just said that, you know, your biggest sort of inflection point, I think from an investment standpoint, and also I think from a significance in terms of taking things to the next level, was the haptics. So that, for those that don't understand, tell us a little bit about that and share what you've done to date.
Sure, yeah. Haptics is a widely used name in the technology arena, but probably less so outside it. And haptics has a wide-ranging interpretation. So you can have a haptic response on your mobile phone. You want your latest smartphone and it vibrates, and that's a haptic response.
Right.
And that's useful. They go from that element right through to force feedback based haptic, and I won't use the technical names for them, but the force feedback haptic being the deployment of pressure, of resistance, of pushback, and you have everything in between. So often you will hear people say,
and just to clarify, when you say force feedback, is that proportional to what you would expect, or is it literally I'm just feeling pressure, or is that even a variation in that force feedback?
Oh yeah, no. Variation based on as close to expected responses within an operating environment. I guess, so the key point here is enough to give you a real life haptic sense of a change of state. So I'll give you an example. So if you are placing a pedicle screw into somebody's spine as part of a fusion procedure, one of the first things you'll do is you'll use a tool called an awl to drill through and make your pathway for that screw to go through.
Right.
You can't see the trajectory of that. Yeah. You can feel it and make sure you don't push too far. And the bone changes in its substance, and we're able to recreate those differences in the texture and the resistance of those different types of tissue as you move through them. So you can feel the visual, the haptic clear as you work your way through. So that's kind of the key part of haptic intelligence is to be able to create those collisions and those interactions with different tissues in real time. The other part of it is there's lots of different haptic devices. You know, there's some great companies. A key point, we don't make any hardware. So our entire model is software only. So what we're doing is working with the best hardware manufacturers out there within the haptic space, within the VR space, to leverage their investment and their technology. So, you know, we have haptic devices which are that give you a force feedback because they push back on you. Other people are making haptic gloves today, which aren't commercially really viable today, but will be in the next 12 months or so. So we built a software package that works across each of those different modalities of haptic devices so that our customers can just plug and play and say, well, actually, I want a glove because what I need to do is put my hand onto a patient.
Right.
Or I need a particular force feedback because I want to drill or cut. And we're able to build that into the simulation system that we've got. So you get those operational feelings and those clues that tell you I need to change my position, change my action, stop, et cetera, et cetera. So you start to get that skills transfer then that happens from learning into real life. And that's the key thing there.
It's extraordinary. You know, the human body and its capacity to sense is just incredibly refined. I mean, no better demonstration of that than we can sense the difference of materials through an extended instrument. So we don't actually have to be touching what it is that we're feeling. You know, example of a spade in soil versus a spade in gravel, we know the difference through that sense. And, you know, achieving that with haptics and feedback, I think, is an extraordinarily challenging function, but essential from a standpoint of a surgeon, because so much of that is feel if you don't have the visual capacity. So, you know, clearly an exciting area, something that you've sort of spent a lot of time and energy. What else is going on? What other things are sort of important in this whole training and surgical experience that you've put together?
Yeah, I think one of the key things that's going on in the virtual reality hardware space right now is what we call standalone devices. They've started to come through low cost. They don't have the full haptic system, but they have a buzz haptic within the controllers. What we're all about at Fundamental is to give our customers the ability to use the system where they want to use it. So we still believe that haptic VR is the best way to learn because of the skill transfer capability. But if you want to take it home with you, we now have ported across to the standalones with a system we're now calling At Home. So same education content, same simulation content, no haptics, so you don't have the sense of touch that you have with our haptic VR system, but the ability to do procedural rehearsal, to get familiar with the anatomy, and to do it on your own time, at home or on the move. Importantly, one user login, so you end up with the same data going to your customer record and your training record, which is important. Both those two systems we're now aligning with the ACGME learning system for orthopedics. And we've received the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeon, as well as the Royal College of Surgeons accreditation for those systems. And that's a key point too. So those are exciting us quite a lot.
So what you're saying is that you can actually get educational credits, is that true?
Yeah, exactly that. So if you spend long enough and to the right level of competency within our system, you can, through the Royal College of Surgeons, you can earn up to 6 CPD points per procedure. With the AAOS, the Academy, you can earn up to 3 CME points for the procedure that you undertake. So yeah, you start to build up your continuous professional development or medical education points as you're using the system, which is great because it recognizes then that actually there's a level of content and knowledge and skills that you're building up that are important.
As you sort of look at the use cases of this, obviously you've got users, you've got the accreditation, any sort of insights about who's using this and the way that they're using this? Is this sort of for people that are prepping for procedures maybe that they're not very familiar with? Is this sort of expanding, democratizing access as you sort of described at the beginning? What's going on in the actual user experience?
You know, it's interesting. We're kind of at both ends of the learning curve and experience curve. So our core system, Fundamental Surgery, which is open to any hospital to license, That's really designed for residents that are kind of year two onwards. So they know the theory, they're hungry for experience, right. And repetition is everything. So they're learning really for the first time how to do it, using a number of different inputs, and our system can go alongside those to give them an acceleration with that. And it can be quite a significant acceleration. The other use of the system is really at the other end. So very experienced surgeons who know the technique, but actually maybe there's a new medical device or a new drug, right. Or a new way of approaching it, and they want to learn that. So they're learning for the first time a slight change in the way of doing it. And we found a lot of use in that space. And there we work with a lot of med device and pharmaceutical businesses to tailor our platform to allow that learning to happen. And the two together work very well.
You know, it's interesting. One of the things about these new devices and, you know, the emergence of them, everybody's very excited when they appear on the availability list. But the challenge is, of course, the training that goes along with that. And quite often there's a very limited number of experts that even know how to do this. So democratizing that access for people to be able to go learn, you know, so that they don't have to travel to the courses, or when they go to the courses, they can be abbreviated, feels like it's a sort of, you know, core principle in all of this. It's not just about CME, it's about expanding access to these new and available devices and techniques.
Absolutely. I was talking the other day to one of the orthopedic bodies in Germany, and they were telling me how they use the phrase training islands. We have lots of training islands. Mm. And what we think we can do with your system and the data that comes through it is actually start to join those up. And I thought that was a really interesting thought in terms of, you know, again, we don't stand alone. We're part of a multimodal training environment. But our system can start to connect those different activities up. And we've got some life sciences businesses that are using us now as part of a training pathway. So pre-cadaveric training, they will use our system to qualify and start the process of learning the skills and the understanding of how to do something before they then go into a cadaveric session at a much higher level of capability than they would otherwise do. So it becomes part of that. And then after that session, they go back onto our system to continue that process. Because again, repetition is key. And if I can give you 200 opportunities to practice this as opposed to two, you're going to have far better competence and far better confidence. And it's those two things, confidence and competence, that need to be developed. I talk constantly with our medical panel across the world, and also a lot of our users, and what they tell me is, you know, the jump off between learning a didactic way of doing something, you know, so learning a process using didactic techniques and then actually going into the OR and doing it, the jump off point is so incredibly steep that anything that bridges that, and this is where our system comes in, really starts to help.
Fantastic. Well, unfortunately, as usual, we've run out of time. It just remains for me to thank you for joining me on the radio show. I think this is exciting time for increasing access, you know, making available much of the training and the experience to a wider population internationally. Richard, thanks for joining me on the show today.
Many thanks, Nick. It's been great to be part of it. Good to chat through. And look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks for joining me today. Do you have any better ideas, or have you found a small incremental change that's brought about a big improvement in your world? Let's continue the conversation on our hashtag, The Incrementalist, or share with me at DrNick1 on Twitter. You can find more information about the show on our program page at healthcarenowradio.com. And tune in next time to hear my discussions with leaders and innovators from around the globe who've revolutionized their space by using small incremental improvements to achieve their moonshot. I'm Dr. Nick, the Incrementalist, and I'm starting a revolution through evolution.